This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to The People Speak. I am Sophia Ray, your host for today. The People Speak encourages listener participation. Please tune in every Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern. You may listen by phone by calling in at 716-748-0144 or tune in by computer or tablet at bbsradio.com. by clicking on the listen icon and navigating to station 2. Listeners can participate during the show by calling their questions in for the guests toll free in USA and Canada at 1-888-429-5471. Our guest tonight is Tenzin Tathong. This is his second appearance on The People Speak. He has an outstanding record of achievement in public service. Mr. Tathong is formerly a representative for His Holiness Dalai Lama in New York and in Washington, D.C. Mr. Tathong is currently with Radio Free Asia as the director of the Tibet sector. He is currently working on a personal project that's aimed to keep the memory alive of the old Tibet. It is an honor to welcome Mr. Tenzin Tathong. Good evening, Tenzin Tathong. How are you tonight?
Good evening. Thank you for having me. I'm very fine tonight. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for being with us tonight. It's an honor to have you on. Thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to start out by giving our viewers and listeners here just a background on yourself and your experiences. If you can start out with that, that would be great.
Sure. Well, to give you a very brief background, I'm a Tibetan, born in Tibet and in 1948, and I came out to India as a child and grew up mostly up to my mid-20s in India. And I went to Tibetan refugee schools and also to a well-known missionary school, a Christian missionary school in Darjeeling. And for the early part of my life, I've been quite involved with the Tibetan refugees who are beginning to resettle and adjust to life in India. So I worked in various capacities, everything from being an interpreter to a translator to being a secretary to being a part-time school teacher to working in a community educational magazine, and also later working in the Exile Tibetan Administration, which previously used to be the Tibetan government in exile. And much later, I came to the United States in the mid-70s when the Exile Tibetan Administration, and especially His Holiness the Dalai Lama, had an appeal on behalf of the Tibetan people and the unfortunate situation in Tibet, an appeal that was before the United Nations. And so there was a small office in New York with two or three people working, trying to reach out to various government representatives at the United Nations. And I did some work in regard to that. But it also was a time when the United States had already changed its policies towards China. China had become a member of the UN, and of course China didn't want the Tibetan issue to be addressed in any way, and most of the world slowly began to accommodate China rather than any human rights or religious freedom issues that were being addressed by people like the Tibetan refugees and the people in Tibet. So in the mid-70s on, basically we had to try and just reach out to the American public, the real public, so to speak, and began to connect with a small circle of friends, people. I think it, to some extent it included scholars and people who knew something about Tibet or India or Buddhism. And it also reached out to a whole new generation of young Americans who had started to travel to India. You know, in the late 60s and 70s, young people traveled across Europe and through Iran and Afghanistan, and many of them ended up in India and Nepal. And mm-hmm. among those, a good many of them first came into contact with Tibetan refugees, Tibetan monks, Tibetan lamas, and those who returned to the United States were natural sort of people to contact for sympathy and support. And beginning with these kind of connections, I think we started to build a small base of genuine understanding and sympathy for the Tibetan people.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually led to the first visit of His Holiness the Dalai Lama in 1979. And then I think you could say after that, it sort of opened the doors quite wide. And many people got to hear and know more about the Dalai Lama as a person, what he stood for and what he taught. And this also gave a greater understanding of the terrible situation in Tibet. So that's what I've been involved in for most of my life. And I did go back to India and also work for a number of years in the exile administration. And by the mid-90s, I came back to the United States on my own. And I've been involved with various Tibetan projects, but I also did some teaching part-time at Stanford University. And right now I'm working in this radio station called Radio Free Asia, which is a very special sort of program which reaches the people of Tibet. And it's a rare opportunity for a Tibetan to be able to sort of communicate and inform people who desperately need, you know, free information, open information about the rest of the world, and also to some extent what's happening inside Tibet. So that's what I'm involved in right now.
Sounds good, sounds good. You know, you mentioned the UN. How, you know, I'm kind of not understanding how the UN is a permanent member. I mean, China being a permanent member in the UN, but still, you know, this conflict is happening with Tibet. You know, how is that affecting, you know, what's currently going on now? Is there any chance that, you know, Tibet could go back to what it was, you know, once was?
Well, I don't think Tibet is ever going back to how it was once before. The world has certainly changed a lot, and circumstances in Tibet have also changed. So I don't think the majority of the Tibetans are simply wishing for an old Tibet to return. But what they do desperately need is freedom and less violence and manipulation in Tibetan life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the initial appeal was at the UN also. Basically an appeal to the world to say, please come and save us, please help us, because we are our lives are being totally controlled by a state, the Chinese Communist state, which does not respect religion or spirituality, and which is trying to enforce a totally alien, shall we say, very materialistic political agenda and a lifestyle on the people of Tibet. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you could say, yes, we've been totally unsuccessful because the modern state of communist China has become such a powerful state. But I think our appeal and the cause of the freedom of the Tibetan people still, you know, is very valid. And there are people who are concerned about it. And we all hope things will change for the better in Tibet. But it has to start in China.
Absolutely, I agree. I do. For those who are just now tuning in, we are speaking with Tenzin Tathong. I am your host, Sophia Ray. Mr. Tathong, during the fall of Tibet to China, you know, there was some, you know, did the U.S. Turn their back on Tibet and sell out to China?
Well, in a way, you could say yes. The U.S. Did not live up to its best ideals or American ideals of freedom all over the world. But one can't entirely blame the United States because Tibet had very little relations with the outside world other than India, Nepal, China, and Mongolia. And so when the Second World War ended and the, shall we say, the post-colonial world came about, the United States really didn't have a proper role in South Asia or that part of the world. Mm-hmm. And China becoming a newly independent communist state also had a much more, shall we say, aggressive agenda. And when mm-hmm. China just marched into Tibet, nobody really knew what to do, and nobody really wanted to confront China as well, India or the United States. And furthermore, the United States was already heavily involved in the Korean War. So I think other more drastic sort of conflicts distracted the world from paying attention to Tibet. And of course, ultimately, the Tibetans were not prepared to fully, you know, engage or preserve our freedoms.
Right. I can see that. There, I have a question from Mike in California. One of his favorite movies is 7 Years in Tibet. He wants to know if you can talk about working as an advisor on that film, and did you meet Brad Pitt, or were you located anywhere on site during the film while it was taking place?
Sure. I was, I guess, quite fortunate enough to be invited to be an advisor to the film. And it was mainly shot in South America. yes, I did meet and I guess you could say work a bit with Brad Pitt. And 7 Years of Tibet is based on a true story of an Austrian, two Austrians who were climbing in the Himalayas just when the Second World War broke out. And so as they were part of the German-Austrian, you know, camps, so to speak, the British authorities arrested them and imprisoned them. Mm-hmm. And they escaped from prison in northern India and fled north into Tibet and somehow managed to make it all the way to Lhasa. And one of them wrote this book called 7 Years in Tibet, which is, I think, very well-known sort of international bestseller for many decades. And this was the film, Hollywood film, that was made on it. So it's based on a true story, and the story itself is fairly accurate in terms of what the author initially wrote.
Okay.
So it's a unique film because very few foreigners, especially Westerners, were able to live and work in Tibet at any time.
Sounds like one I need to watch.
Yes, you might enjoy it.
I've been meaning to get to see it, but I haven't been able to get to it yet. I have another question that's coming in from Bobby in Ireland. He's asking about in 1962, the China and India went to war. Ultimately, China won, he's saying, the war. He said India claimed South Tibet. Does part of the Free Tibet program involve the freedom of South Tibet from India?
Well, this area where this gentleman is referring to South Tibet, as the Chinese call it, is presently a state within India called Arunachal Pradesh. Mm-hmm. And this was a territory which was part of Tibet once. And when the British government was in India, Tibet and India had some negotiations where the territory was ceded to British India. So after the British left India, the Indian government took over all of India, as you know. And when the Chinese came into Tibet, they started to raise the issue of this territory that was conceded to British India. And basically, the Chinese have been saying that this is Tibetan territory taken away by unequal treaties and by force by the British. And so while the territory was under Indian control, in 1962, Chinese troops just marched into the area and actually took over temporarily for a few weeks. And then they withdrew voluntarily, saying that we have now taught India a lesson. But the claim still stands. In Chinese maps, they record this territory as South Tibet, whereas in India, in the Indian map, it's Arunachal Pradesh, and it is actually administered by the Indian authorities. So it's an area that is going to remain contentious between India and China.
Okay, I see. You know, I want to go back a little bit and ask you about Radio Free Asia. And is there any conflict with that radio station and the China government? Are they trying to censor what is being said on the radio show there?
Yes. Radio Free Asia broadcasts in several languages, Asian languages, Chinese, Tibetan, Cantonese, and also Vietnamese and Lao and Burmese. Mm-hmm. And also the language of the Uyghur people in northwestern China, called the Uyghur Autonomous Region. So all these programs of Radio Free Asia try to inform the people in these countries with free, open information about what's happening in the world, as well as what's happening locally through news reports and through citizen reporters and stringers. And the Chinese government is not pleased with that, especially in the Tibetan areas and the Uyghur areas. And where possible, they are jamming it in cities and towns, and trying to prevent anybody from listening to these programs. But the technology keeps changing, and people are finding new ways to listen to it through other means of broadcast over satellite, through the internet. And people are also now able to download apps and listen to these programs on the phone and other social media that is open in China. So as much as they're being censored and blocked and jammed in by the Chinese authorities, a lot of it is getting through to the people.
Well, I hope that, you know, that it continues to get through to the people. I think that this matter is very important, and it's, you know, it's kind of affects everybody worldwide here. I have another question, and this question is coming in from Kim in Ohio. Kim is asking, can the guest speak about how His Holiness the Dalai Lama feels about the current situation in Tibet and why he seemed to have distanced himself from it? Himself from by saying that he will be a religious leader rather than more of a having a political role.
Yeah. Well, it's a very complicated but very appropriate question and difficult one. Basically, right now, you could say, in a way, he is distancing himself from the Tibetan issue on two levels. On a larger sort of picture, he has always been calling for true social and democratic changes in Tibet, right from the 1950s, actually, before he left Tibet. And especially after he came into exile also, he encouraged the exile community and those who are working for and calling for a free Tibet to function in very democratic ways. So in the exile community, the main administration and the various institutions and societies have all been trying to function in a very transparent, modern, democratic way. And he believes that the time of kings and autocrats and even popes and Dalai Lamas, that time is over. And as the world moves forward, the democratic ways of governance is the best form. And so he's deliberately trying to distance himself from politics on these grounds. And he's been quite successful in many ways, although he still remains extremely popular among Tibetans. I think it's almost universally accepted as still their leader in many ways. So that's the general sort of picture of his sort of distancing himself from the Tibetan issue. More recently, if the questioner may be referring to his distancing himself from some recent developments in Tibet, you know, in the last 2 years or more, over 130 Tibetans have self-immolated. They've burnt their bodies in some protest, in a form of protest against Chinese rule, protests for greater freedom, and also calling on for the return of His Holiness the Dalai Lama to Tibet. So on this issue, of course, it's a terrible, terrible development in Tibet, and it's really affected the Tibetans in both in Tibet and everybody outside a great deal. Mm-hmm. And nobody feels comfortable saying whether these actions are to be praised and acknowledged properly, or whether they should be halted, because the people who are doing these are not, shall we say, crazy nuts. Many of them have been very deliberate. They've left behind them. They've said very clearly that they are sacrificing their lives, knowing that they are going to suffer and die, and some family members may also suffer in the process. But they want to draw attention to the fact that there is a serious lack of freedom for the Tibetan people, that there is great frustration. People want change, and people want the Dalai Lama to come back. And so most exiles also find it very difficult to say how to accept these. And the Dalai Lama has obviously been questioned by media and people all over the world, what he should be saying. And he's said that, you know, I don't think I should say anything right now, because whatever I say is going to misrepresented and misportrayed by Chinese authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the situation right now with regard to that issue.
Okay. I have a, for those who are tuning in to the People Speak at the moment, I'm Sophia Ray, and I am talking with Tenzin Tathong, and we are currently discussing issues that are going on in Tibet. One more question before we go on break here. I have a question from April in New York. Do you think the Tibetans think they can employ the tactics of Gandhi in opposing China and bring world focus on their situation?
Well, you know, I think the Tibetans have been greatly influenced by Gandhi and also Dr. Martin Luther King. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been preaching the same message for the last 50 or 60 years, saying that our struggle for freedom must be always nonviolent. So I think the basic message is understood, and the attempt to be nonviolent is definitely part of the Tibetan struggle. However, because there is a serious lack of free communication with the people in Tibet, there is no opportunity to learn the finer points of nonviolent resistance. As a society, we don't fully know all the subtleties and the details of how a nonviolent effort should be carried out. Furthermore, we are frustrated because we are dealing with an authoritarian government that is completely disrespecting any sense of law and order or any thought of justice, you know. Gandhi could at least go to court in India, to a British court. So could Dr. King do that and gain the support of churches in America, or the court system, the legal system. Unfortunately, in Tibet, you can't appeal to the court because there is no thing. And nor can we appeal to the political leaders because they are a monolithic communist party, you know, system. And so in that frustration, some of these recent self-immolations, I think, are meant to be non-violent protests in a way, because the person is saying, I'm going to sacrifice my life, but I'm not going to harm a single other person, be it a Tibetan or a Chinese official or a Chinese soldier or even Chinese property. I'm just going to take my life to show the depth of my frustration. So it's tragic and desperate for people who are trying to carry out this non-violent struggle.
Yeah, I think the non-violent struggle is an important one. You know, I think that we should be expressing non-violence more. It seems like we are living in a time that it's very violent. We see violence everywhere, all over the TV, movies, you name it. I believe that right now is a good time to cut into a break, and we will be back in just a moment with Tenzin Tathong.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Got questions? questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit UNICEFUSA.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
And we're back. This is your host, Sophia Ray, and we are with our guest, Tenzin Tathong, and we're discussing currently the long issues that have been going on with Tibet. We have some more questions from the viewers, Mr. Tathong. I have a question that's coming in from Carl in Wisconsin, and he is asking, do you think that China's government violations of human rights are as bad as the U.S. government's current violations of human rights, such as that in Gitmo? And also, he wants to know who can act as the world's moral leaders when everyone is engaging in torture now after 9/11?
Okay. Well, I think as far as human rights abuses in Tibet goes, as in China, these human rights violations have been going on for some more than 50 years in Tibet. And so there's a wide range of abuses, everything from the individual imprisonment, death, torture, to the whole society being traumatized for decades in a row. So, in some ways, the suffering of one individual, can't be compared to, in terms of numbers, the gravity of such things. So it's difficult to compare what may have happened in Gitmo or is happening there. But any torture or mistreatment of a human being, obviously, should not be accepted or approved in any way. So I think whoever is responsible for a violation of human rights in any form has to be responsible. So the only thing that I can say is I don't know the details of Gitmo as much as I should know, maybe, but at least I hear now and then that some form of trial is being attempted, that some process of a legal process to try them and there are all kinds of legal issues that prevent them from a proper trial, either in Gitmo or outside Gitmo. Mm-hmm. And so at least there's some semblance of legality that is being pursued to establish truth or justice of one person's crime or innocence. And you should remember that in places like Tibet, there is none of that. So there is some, I think one has to make some distinctions with regard to that. And as far as moral, anyone being in position of moral leadership, I would, it's difficult to say, but I think anybody who is serving the cause of human freedom, mm-hmm. who is serving community where there is need, whether it's for food or shelter or for medicine or safety, mm-hmm. I think those individuals and groups that are doing that kind of work are providing the moral leadership in the world. It's obviously not prime ministers and presidents and rich and big governments. They are sort of the poorest performers, if I might say. So the moral leadership, I think there's plenty around, and it comes from individuals and groups that are serving the most needy.
Okay. To our viewers, this is the time to call in your questions at 1-888-429-5471, or you can call in at 530-413-9537 to speak with Mr. Tathong and ask your questions or comments. I'm going to go to another viewer's question here, and this one's coming in from Greg in New York. Who owns the currency used in China, and who controls the central bank there, if they have one? Does Tibet use the same currency that is used in China?
In Tibet, the people have to use the Chinese currency. That is the official denomination, obviously, throughout China. And as far as who owns these banks, in China is supposed to be a modern socialist people's republic. But in reality, one could say much is owned by the Communist Party of China. And more than just the party itself, the top echelon of its leaders basically own a lot of whatever China is producing and becoming rich these days. So it's controlled by a very elite group of people. They probably own China right now.
All right. Another question came in from Phil in California. He's asking, do you think the largest countries like Russia, China, and the U.S. could be behind some of the largest terrorist attacks like 9/11 and other attacks and bombings around the world?
From my observation or limited experiences, I don't think these big governments, as powerful as they are capable of planning such, shall we say, sophisticated things which has every possibility of going in the wrong direction, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I suppose these are somewhat, you know, linked to like conspiracy theories. And while they may appear to be answering a lot of doubts and we may have, I think it would be too complicated for any big government to even try to plan to do such things. But one never knows. I'm not privy to, what strange, mm-hmm. secret plans that go on in rich governments or secretive governments.
Right. All right. I have another question coming in, and this one is from Harold in Kentucky. Are you familiar with the plight of Falun Gong practitioners in China, and what are your feelings towards that group and situation there, if you are?
I'm a little familiar with the Falun Gong. I think, I believe it's people who are have become very deeply interested in spirituality as well as good health, and it stems from Chinese traditions of Qigong meditation, as well as certain influences of Buddhism and Taoism. And it became popular more than 20 years ago, started to gain a lot of following because there's a tremendous, one could say, spiritual or moral, you know, gap in Chinese society. Mm-hmm. And it's had a tremendous growth and following throughout China. But the president of China at the time, Jiang Zemin, for some reason had a tremendous fear of this group. I believe people say it's primarily because the people are so involved, so dedicated, and he feared that they were more organized than any other group in China, and felt that it was a great threat to the communist system. And since then, they have been obviously persecuted tremendously in China. And millions of Chinese who feel the need for spirituality and humanness in society are part of this movement. And so I hope that the Falun Gong practitioners will gain greater freedom and respect for what they're trying to do.
I do too. You know, speaking of spirituality and stuff, I'm interested to know, you know, there in some schools of thought, it's been taught that religion is believed to be created by a spiritual personality of an avatar. Do you think religion was created by a spiritual avatar? And do you think it was created to become aware of the God spirit, or do you think it was created to for control and order and over the masses of the people?
Well, you know, I'm not, shall we say, learned in any spiritual tradition, really, nor could I claim to be a dedicated, serious practitioner of any sort. But I have been very deeply influenced by Buddhist practices because I grew up in a Buddhist family and a Buddhist society. And I've been influenced by Buddhist teachers, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama, all my life. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I also went to a missionary school for a number of years where we not only read the Bible, we actually studied the Bible, we prayed, we sang hymns and spirituals, and in some ways I got a very good education about Christianity. And having lived in India, you're also exposed to a number of other spiritual traditions. So I don't believe any of these religious traditions have been organized to control people or society. Its traditions have emerged out of some individual realization or an individual search for an understanding of the universe. Mm-hmm. And I'm fully aware that, you know, many religious traditions accept the idea of a god, a deity, or creator. And there are others like Buddhists who don't, in a philosophical sense, accept an actual creator deity, mm-hmm. except the idea of some greater spirituality, I suppose you could say a godlike presence out there. So I don't speak in particular terms about any of these, really. I'm still, I guess you could say, learning and open to spiritual experiences.
I got you. For those who are just tuning in to The People Speak, I am Sophia Ray, your host for the evening, and we are speaking with Mr. Tenzin Tathong, who is currently in position with the Radio Free America as the director of the Tibetan sector. You know, I kind of want to go back and just ask, you know, China seems to be very unreligious, more very, very political, as you had said. Do you think China is at the front lines right now in the movement of trying to kill out the dogma or just religion completely?
Well, officially, China is, you could say yes, officially and in reality opposed to any religious tradition in China. So in Tibet, the monasteries are controlled or people are not actually permitted to fully practice in various religious activities. And then just as we talked about, the Falun Gong followers and practitioners are persecuted in China. And although there's a growth in Christians in China, they are very severely being sort of suppressed by Chinese authorities. So officially, religion and spiritual traditions have a tremendous challenge in the authoritarian state of China.
Mm-hmm. You know, I do understand that you have, you know, some background in the education systems. You know, I know that in China they have a great education, especially with like sciences and mathematics. And here in America, we are lacking in those areas. Do you know or have an idea why the education is so dumbed down?
I couldn't say for sure, but you know, the way we are looking at education for the Tibetans who are in exile is we are trying to look at education as a modern, in a modern context. So mm-hmm. all the Tibetan exile or refugee children are being educated in a modern Indian high secondary system. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we are trying to continue with classes and special programs in introducing and teaching them the fundamentals of Buddhist principles. Mm-hmm. So these are in the regular sort of high school, so to speak. And then a good segment of younger people still study in the traditional monastics or monasteries in India and Nepal. Mm-hmm. And in these monasteries, the education is primarily traditional Buddhist curriculum. And that's how it's been for a long time. But in the last 20 years, even the monasteries have started to become a little different in the sense that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been encouraging the monastic institutions to also incorporate learning about modern science. Mm. So various programs to teach them fundamentals of chemistry to physics and modern research work being done in psychology and neurology are also being incorporated in traditional Buddhist teachings. And sort of the to sort of simplify what the Dalai Lama is trying to do is that he's saying the spirituality that we practice or we try to implement in our lives must also conform to or be corroborated by what we know with modern science as well. Mm-hmm. Everything must be tested and true for the individual. We can't simply be, shall we say, abstract. So we're in a state of trying to do both traditional spirituality and spiritual practices with as much as possible modern science. So it's a tricky thing. There are some who are very conservative, who don't think we should be mixing things too much. But by and large, the Tibetan community and the Tibetan Buddhist sort of community worldwide is going through this somewhat experimental phase of modernizing an ancient tradition.
Yeah, I think you bring up some really important things, you know, when it comes with science and spirituality, because, you know, there seems to have been an emergence there, especially with psychology. You know, I'm interested in what you think as far in the lines between true spirituality and the spirituality that seems to be like a direct force upon people. I think, is there a difference there, do you think?
Between true spirituality and spirituality that's being forced on people in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, again, I can only sort of speak from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. And one of the things Tibetan Buddhists are often reminded of or taught is that even when the Buddha was alive and when he taught his philosophy, he said that that no one should accept his words because he is the Buddha, but that you should test it for yourself and see if it works.
So I agree.
You know, so there is this, I guess you could say, rational or practical aspect to a practicing Buddhist. Whatever you learn or whatever you feel sounds good should be tested in your by yourself to see if it really benefits you, if it really makes you better, or if it really calms you, if it really makes you more compassionate, you know. So I can only add, you know, that part to what you were just asking.
I understand, no problem. You know, before the show closes out here, you know, I know that you've been through a lot. You kind of experienced a lot and been in different situations, different countries, moving from Tibet to India and such forth. Can you tell us, you know, what is the most important lesson you have learned through all of your experiences?
Well, I think one of the most important lessons is you have to find a way to survive, in a sense, right? It's ultimately about the survival of the individual and your group.
Mm-hmm.
And to survive, you have to be able to adapt. And the best survival and the best adaptation is done when you are as true as possible to yourself. By that, we need to be functioning with integrity, with honesty, and with, shall we say, kindness or compassion to yourself and others.
Absolutely.
And not simply take shortcuts and grab things, you know, so to speak.
Absolutely, because when we take shortcuts, we get cut short. I agree.
Yes.
You know, I just, before, you know, a closing note here, can you tell our viewers anything that you want them to be aware of with the current situations that are at hand right now, either with Tibet or just within anything that, you know, is there anything that you want us to be aware of?
Well, I always want people to know that, of course, Tibet is very special to me as a Tibetan, and I have many special things to say about what's happening in Tibet, good and bad. And I say, if you pay attention to Tibet, it might be worthwhile not just for the people of Tibet, but because this is emblematic of many other peoples and cultures who are also going through these difficult challenges. And for all of us to understand these challenges better, it will make all of us and the whole world better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it was a pleasure having you on the show today. tonight again. In the future, would you be willing to come back and talk with us again?
Sure, I'd be happy to, yes.
It would be a pleasure to have you back. It was a great time chatting with you. Thank you so much, Mr. Tithong, okay. For being here with us tonight.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. We are closing out our show for tonight here, folks. Next week, we will be having General Albert Stubblebine and his wife on the show. So please tune in next week for that show. And I want to give thanks to our viewers and listeners and to Mr. Tenzin Tathong. Thank you so much. Also, a great thanks and hand applause to our engineer, Don Newsom at BBS Radio. Everybody, have a good night, and thank you for tuning in.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.